Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
88% of farms are considered small family farms, but these farms only account for 46% of agricultural land operated and 19% of the value of production.
Catherine Lacey with the Economic Research Service on the types of small family farms.
A retirement farm is a small farm with a principal operator who reports having retired from farming while continuing to farm on a small scale. An off-farm occupation farm is a farm with a principal occupator who reports a primary occupation other than farming. We have farming occupation farms with a principal operator who reports farming as their primary occupation, and this category is split into two groups. Low sales or farming occupation farms with gross cash farm income less than $150,000 a year. Moderate sales are farming occupation farms with gross cash farm income greater than or equal to $150,000 and less than $350,000 a year.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
My entire first year, well, my first 11 months, we could not travel out of Beijing because of the lockdowns. The penalty was, if you want to go to Shenyang or Chengdu, you could go, but then you'd stay there for 10 days under lockdown. You couldn't get back to the capital. Too high a price to pay.
Nicholas Burns is the U.S. ambassador to China. Speaking recently at the Brookings Institute on U.S.-Chinese relations.
We had lockdowns and mandates in China that made it impossible for my staff and I to travel. Shanghai lockdown, our consulate lockdown there. Real crisis situation. The president had a good meeting in Bali at the end of 2022, but then you all remember the balloon incident of the beginning of February of 23. That was preceded by the controversy over Speaker Pelosi's visit. So the Chinese reaction both to Speaker Pelosi and the balloon incident was to shut down most senior level conversations between the U.S. and China. I thought that was very dangerous and ill-advised of the Chinese. And as of late spring, early summer of this year, we were in a situation where we did not have any highly developed cabinet contacts. Mm-hmm. We didn't have channels where the Secretary of State or Treasury or Commerce could call their counterparts and work out issues. We were active in Beijing. Obviously, that's our job, but you want to have that higher level. And so we decided, along with the Chinese, that we had to change that situation. So it's been a remarkable last 7-8 months. Secretary Blinken was the first Secretary of State to visit China in 4.5 years. That was June. Secretary Yellen came out in July, first Secretary of the Treasury in 4.5, 5 years. Secretary Raimondo came out on her first visit to China, first visit by Secretary of Commerce in 4 or 5 years. You can see how separated we have become. John Kerry came out. The really extraordinary visit, in a way, was Henry Kissinger's visit. 100 years of age, I met him at the airport. It was about 102 degrees in mid-July, 2 in the afternoon, and he had just had a 20-hour flight. And he came off the plane and engaged in 5 days of conversations with Xi Jinping. He did a half-day seminar on AI with China's leading, along with Eric Schmidt, with China's leading AI scientists. He came to the embassy, and 700 of us honored him for being the father of this relationship in many ways. So I think that visit was not our visit. He was invited by President Xi, but it helped to normalize the coming together of the two peoples. And then we had the first visit by a congressional delegation, any congressional delegation, when Majority Leader Chuck Schumer came, 3 Democrats, 3 Republicans, 80-minute meeting with Xi Jinping on fentanyl, on trade and investment, on the Gaza war. We came together. We re-engaged. Our first governor came out, Gavin Newsom, shortly thereafter. So I take you through that list. We had nothing like this in 2020, 2021, 2022. The two governments had separated. What we've done is to plug the governments back in together so that we can at least have open conversation on the competition side and the cooperation side. And I think over the next 12 months or so, as I look at 2024, implementing the agreements from California is going to be very important. Keeping the two governments connected through thick and thin is important. The Chinese practice, when you hit major speed bumps, is to disengage. That is not smart. And we want to keep these contacts going. So that's where we are in terms of the methodology of this relationship.
U.S. Ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns, recently at the Brookings Institute. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Information about this came out about maybe a month and a half ago, so very new.
It's Allison Rivera, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, on a new insurance product for cow-calf producers.
I think this just goes along the lines of in this space where NCBA has been trying to work with USDA, not only for more tools in the toolbox in the risk management space for cattle producers, but specifically maybe more, you know, cow-calf producers. And again, a lot of the work we've been doing is trying to educate producers of the programs that are out there that are available. You know, there's a lot of programs out there under that risk management title. And so we just want to make sure that producers know that there are programs available. This program is very new, so new that we are going to have those who are selling this new pilot program come speak to the Ag and Food Policy Committee meeting at our convention, our NCBA convention in late January, so that producers have the ability to ask very specific questions about this. It is a four-state pilot program, and, you know, I think that it being a new tool specifically for the cow-calf producers out there, we're excited that, you know, there's a new tool out there. So looking forward to kind of diving deeper into this program and making sure that everybody has the correct information on it.
Now, there are other livestock-related insurance programs, but this one geared towards cow-calf producers.
Sure. I think it's specifically an insurance option for cow-calf producers. Again, four states designed to protect the profitability of their spring calving. We know that weather is going to continue. We know that bad weather is going to continue. And so I think this is just another opportunity for that risk management. The protection would ensure that producers against their calves declining in price due to decreased weaning weight caused by things like drought, which we, you know, right now we're seeing a pretty bad drought in the South, in Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi areas. So excessive moisture, hail, wind, frost, insects, disease, you name it. So as we continue to face more environmental challenges, hard winters in particular, flooding, this is just going to be another tool to protect those cow-calf producers.
And it's a pilot program to begin with in 2024 for four states.
Colorado, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Texas. And that was a very important question. Sophie, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners were keen on what states those are. And again, Colorado, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Texas. And again, in a pilot form, you know, USDA will gather information about how the program is being used, whether it's working. And then as they do with a lot of pilot programs, if it's successful, then we can work with them to expand the coverage for further states.
But from the insurance program to the farm bill, building coalitions will be a key to getting the new farm bill.
That's been our goal since the beginning, and I think there's a lot of very intelligent members of Congress that know that that's what they have to do, and specifically, you know, leadership. There are, just as a reminder to your listeners, there are plenty of Democrats in Congress, you know, they're obviously not members of the Freedom Caucus, that do want to support a farm bill and do support agriculture and do support cattle producers. And NCBA works directly with those members. If you are supportive of cattle producers and the work that they're out there doing, then we're going to find a way to work with you.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Diabetes is the single most expensive disease in America. It's 33% of all healthcare spending. It's 31% of Medicare. 31% of Medicare is associated with diabetes.
What's the biggest source of our debt? David Schweikert, Arizona representative.
So, a few months ago, we actually had a healthcare innovation summit downstairs. We actually got six members of Congress to show up. We invited all of them. But six showed up to meet the company that looks like they have a cure for type 1 diabetes. And the fact that the other company sitting next to them looks like they had a path for type 2. But remember, that technology, there's four or five companies, because if type 1 is an autoimmune disease, what happened if you could teach your body not to attack its cells? That one's actually, I think, heading towards its phase one. Why, if these things are so expensive in society, why can't we actually fixate on them? Of the $327 billion spent on diabetes by insurance and government, that's in 2017, $327 billion. We're going to knife each other around here for a few hundred million, maybe a several billion dollars of savings. Incremental changes here on just helping our brothers and sisters if we could get to a cure of diabetes. And now here where it gets actually politically even trickier. Research exploring use of gene therapy to slow promising shows promising results of a diabetic, retinopathy. So I represent a population, a tribal population, that apparently, I've been told, is the second highest per capita population of diabetes in the world. And it's not a poor tribe. They're incredibly well managed. They're prosperous. And as we've learned now because of the GLP-1s, that obesity really has a huge genetic component. You know, the hormones you produce to know you're full is different between you and I. What happens when even our brothers and sisters who are going blind because of diabetes? We're on the cusp of the cure there. But I would actually go even more creative. If anyone's willing to read and read something that's a little bit complex, about 6 months ago, the Joint Economic Committee Republicans, so these are, you know, a couple have PhDs in economics. We wrote a response to the president's budget, but we took it further. We said, think about what we could do for society if we were willing actually to do something about obesity in America. Turns out, remember how I just showed you that 5% is 50% of healthcare spending? Some of the data from The Economist came back and said, hey, almost half of healthcare actually has an association with obesity in America. Okay, this is where it gets tricky, but math is math. So in that, they did very conservative math, and they were coming up with saying, hey, you know, at the end of 10 years, that's $5+ trillion of savings. And if you did the multiplier effects, you might actually, you know, being able to work, family formation, labor force participation, life expectancy, you start to add in those other benefits, it could be several trillion dollars besides the basic morality. So how do you get there? Well, you have some new categories of drugs, the GLP-1s. One apparently goes off patent next year. Could we actually, as a policy here in Congress, encourage a co-op? Make the one that's off patent. Add competition. Crash the price.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We're trying to balance the national security interests on competition with the national security interests on engagement.
U.S. Ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns.
We have a $690 billion two-way trade relationship between the U.S. and China. China's the third largest trade partner. Number one and two are Mexico and Canada, free trade neighbors of the United States. 750,000 American jobs depend on trade with China. Largest market for agriculture, consumer products, health care. Look at the major parts of the American economy. 40 years has developed this extraordinary symbiosis in the two economies. We made a determination early on that Secretary Yellen articulated right across the street at Johns Hopkins. And then Jake Sullivan came here to Brookings to articulate last spring, we're not trying to decouple these two economies. Secretary Yellen was very specific. She said that would be a disaster for the American and Chinese economies and the global economy. I was with her last night. We both spoke at the gala dinner of the U.S.-China Business Council. She went through this again and said, we are not trying to decouple. President Biden said at his press conference in California, we are against decoupling, so we're not trying to tear this relationship apart. Jake Sullivan came here in a very important speech, and I read the Q&A from Brookings last spring, and the Q&A is really important, where he said, okay, we're not decoupling, but we have to de-risk. What does that mean? The fundamental lesson we draw from the pandemic is that you don't want to have undue reliance on critical materials and critical supplies from a country that might practice economic coercion against you in a crisis. You want to bring the supply chain for certain products and supplies closer to home. The United States itself or Mexico or Ireland, some trusted source. And Jake focused on what Secretary Raimondo's focused on. We want to prevent dual-use exports from American companies into China, prevent their use by the PLA to modernize and therefore compete with the United States military in the future. The example is October 2022, and the additional action we took on October 2023, we have shut down the ability of American companies to export advanced semiconductors, particularly for AI applications, into the Chinese economy. Why? There's a civil-military fusion. The government of China can go to any Chinese company and say, we want that IP, we want that product, we're going to use it for intelligence or military purposes. It's in our national interest, and it's irrefutable to keep that technology part of the battle outside of China. Secretary Raimondo was very effective on this issue during her visit in August. She said to the Chinese leadership, I'm not going to compromise with you on these dual-use technologies. They are non-negotiable. This is our national security. And we've all said that to the Chinese leadership. So de-risking, yes. Decoupling, no. We want to continue a major trade and investment relationship with China, just not in the in the realm that might help them leapfrog over us sometime in the next 10 years in military technology.
So what about the accusations?
First of all, they were accusing. They said, you're decoupling. And I kept saying, we're de-risking. And there's a fundamental difference between the two. What they forget, and which I have pointed out to them and others have, is you're doing the same thing. China began its real de-risking with Made in China 2025, which they made public in 2015. They accuse us of de-risking when they've been doing the same thing. These are logical policies for both of us to follow. We're just a little bit more transparent about what we're doing than the Chinese are.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think we are, you know, really kind of on the short rows as far as, you know, cotton still in the field.
Sean Wade is with Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers on the 2023 harvest.
And that's reflecting in some of the reports we're getting from the gents as well, where a lot of gents are forecasting themselves to be complete with their ginning operations, you know, by Christmas, if not Christmas, a lot of them maybe by New Year's or shortly after New Year. So we're definitely on the downhill side of this crop and you know, we'll begin to really kind of get a much bigger picture or better picture of, you know, exactly what kind of production we ended up with out of the 2023 crop. You know, we all know it was pretty down and fairly comparable, I would say, probably to the 2022 growing season when all is said and done. And that's going to be two very, very difficult years back-to-back for both producers and especially for our infrastructure.
And while that is pretty grim when it comes to the cotton that was actually harvested, Wade says,
if there's a bright spot that we would love to, you know, to be able to point to, especially for those of folks, you know, that are out there that may be looking to buy some cotton from West Texas, is that, you know, we may not have a lot of cotton this year, you know, available. But what we do have has been remarkably good on the quality side. You know, we're averaging 21 color and 35 staple pretty much across the board in the Lubbock and Lamesa classing regions. You know, good micronaire, you know, all the quality parameters really are kind of right there where you'd want them to be, you know, considered a very good high quality crop. So, that is a bright spot and we're glad, you know, that those numbers are holding up and, you know, we're beginning to see, like I said, you know, the latter part of the crop come in and sometimes you'll see a little bit of a dip in quality as, you know, maybe some of those lower yielding fields that producers kind of left to the end begin to come in. But again, so far, pretty pleased with the fact that the quality has been pretty consistent throughout the growing season so far.
But the crop that was in the field might have been harvested with a plow.
Certainly, we're still seeing some of those acres be failed out, and you can see that in the FSA, USDA Farm Service Agency's certified acreage report. When you kind of look at the changes from the November report to the December report that was also released on December the 8th, you can see that, especially on the dryland side, you know, we basically increased almost double the number of failed acres on the dryland side from the 1st of November to the 1st of December. So we went from about 675,000 acres of failed dryland cotton in the High Plains on November 1 to just a little bit shy of 1.2 million dryland acres having been failed as of December the 1st. So it's a big jump, you know, from 1 month to the next. And we would probably still expect to see some acres still kind of coming in under that failed acreage, you know, moving from the standing acres or harvested acres line column to over to the failed acreage column. And that's what you're seeing reflected, I think, in the USDA NAS crop production report, where, you know, they basically took the Texas production area and reduced that estimate of production from about 3.6 million bales for the state of Texas to 3.1 million bales. So that's a pretty big cut. And most of that is again, they haven't adjusted their failed acreage estimate at the National Ag Statistics Service yet. But what you saw was a pretty significant decline in the expected yield per acre from the state. So almost, if I'm looking at that right, about a 70-pound decline in the average yield per acre for the state of Texas is what they're projecting in December. So going from just about a bale an acre at 487 pounds per acre on November 1st down to 419 pounds per acre on December 1st. So, you know, it's been a very tough production season when the state average production number is less than a bale an acre.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Someone like me comes and fixates on the debt, and the Democrats are there fixated on wanting to tax people more.
If the nation does not address its debt crisis, it could be catastrophic. Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
For the last couple months, I've come here and showed you the academic literature over and over and over that says you can raise rich people's taxes all you want, you hit the economic ceiling, and you get about a point and a half. Maybe if the sky opened up and everything went, you got up to almost 2% of GDP. Over here, we've talked through almost everything we're able to cut. And there's only a couple percent of GDP that we could ever cut and survive, you know, to just get the vote. Problem is, if you do, you take away the fraud of crediting back to the administration the student loan money, you add it all up, we borrowed almost 8.4% of the economy last year. So borrowing last year was 8.4% of GDP. Did you hear my math? If taxing rich people only gets you a couple percent of GDP and the cuts we want to talk about, and many of the cuts I'm absolutely going to vote for, but it's only a couple percent of GDP, does someone see a problem in the math? It has to happen through policy. Is having a healthier society that needs dramatically less health care, is that moral? Because it's surely great damn economics. The point of tonight's presentation is actually clear. There is hope, but the idiocy often of our, we've calcified intellectually. The left somehow thinks there's a path to tax your way to prosperity. I've tried to show repeatedly that if we did every tax the Democrats talk about to save the Social Security Trust Fund, you get close, but you still actually have very substantial cuts. I mean, we've tried to model it, but let's say it covered everything. You've just used up all your gunpowder. So how are you going to, if two-thirds of all future borrowing is functionally Medicare, where do you get the cash for that? Because you've used it to shore up the Social Security Trust Fund. And that's actually part of the intellectual vacuousness of this place, is we'll just tax more. But there's not enough money, but we're not going to tell anyone that because it doesn't fit what we said on the campaign trail. How many times have some of my brothers and sisters on my side, it's foreign aid? And then you show the chart that every dime of foreign aid is about 11 days of borrowing. Remember, we're on the cusp of borrowing $7 billion a day. We're over $80,000 a second now. We're going to have to change through policy. I've done videos on how you could have a revolution on environmental by crowdsourcing the data. And I even made a whole cartoon, it's on YouTube somewhere, of crowdsourcing environmental data, that if you did that, you don't need the current enforcement mechanism, because if you have enough data, you catch the bad actors. It would open up the economy, promote growth, and you'd catch the clowns that are breaking the rules. And I've showed that to people around here and say, oh, but that would cut a whole bunch of jobs at the EPA. That's the point. It's better, faster, and better for the environment, and a hell of a lot cheaper and fairer. There are solutions. There are hope. But they're only going to come about if we have intellectually a fairly dramatic change in how we've sort of calcified on policy. Because all these things are disruptive. All these things are going to have armies of lobbyists who do not like them because you're changing their business model. Or armies of bureaucrats showing up in your office explaining that you're changing how the law is or how they are. That's the point. There's hope. It just requires us to change.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Some experts say if Congress fails to come up with a budget bill that fully funds the Agriculture Department's nutrition program for low-income women, infants, and children, WIC for short,
states may need to cut participation by 2 million people by next September.
This is especially troubling because WIC serves nearly 40% of all infants in the United States.
That last voice belongs to USDA Deputy Secretary Sochil Torres-Small. She joined several WIC program supporters in telling reporters about the benefits of this nearly 50-year-old program.
We've seen that it drives down health care costs and increases preventative care. Studies show that WIC decreases infant deaths, premature births, and also reduces the risk of low birth weights. And in early childhood, WIC participation is also associated with higher test scores.
The WIC program does this by bringing low-income women and children special supplemental nutritious foods along with nutrition information and health care referrals. Gary Crawford, Washington.